Chapter 34 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legimus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 34. I had met Crossland for the first time 2 or 3 years before, when he was introduced to me at a music hall one evening by Mr. Hannaford Bennett. Crossland told me on that occasion that he had been reader to Grant Richards when the question of publishing my volume of poetry, The City of the Soul, had come up in 1899. Crossland told me that it was he who induced Grant Richards to publish it, and that in his opinion it was far beyond any contemporary poetry. Whether or not this statement of his as to his share in bringing about the publication of my volume was accurate, I have no means of knowing. I think that, as a matter of fact, it was my cousin, Wilfred Blunt, who arranged with Mr. Grant Richards to publish my book, and I doubt if Crossland had anything to do with it, though I do not question for a moment that he read it in manuscript and greatly admired it. Some years later, he begged me to allow him to write an introductory note to the edition of my sonnets, which was published by the Academy Publishing Company, while I was editing the paper. In that note, he claimed that the best of my sonnets were equal to the best that had ever been written, and that several of them will endure as long as poetry is read, and as long as the English language is understood. It was natural that I should be pleased to meet a man who had such a high opinion of my work, and from that day I saw a lot of Crossland, and later I was for several years on terms of the greatest friendship with him. He was a most extraordinary man. Someone once wittily described his appearance by saying that he looked like an inspired bus conductor. Undoubtedly, he had genius. He has written some very fine poetry. Some of the best of it appeared in the Academy under my editorship, and also a good deal that is nothing like so fine, and occasionally gets perilously near to doggerel, especially in the poems he churned out week by week during the war. But all poets must be judged by their best work, and at his best, Crossland was superb. All his best sonnets were written when he was with me on the Academy. He had what I can only describe as a slightly defective ear for rhythm, as far as his own work was concerned. It appeared to be impossible for him to produce a sonnet which did not contain at least one line with too many feet in it. As long as he was with me, I used to employ every art I possessed in the way of tact and cajolery and argument to make him correct these blemishes. He would argue fiercely that they were not blemishes, and that he wrote the lines in question in that way, on purpose to produce a rugged effect. If everything else failed, I used to adopt an air of aggrieved resignation. Crossland called it sulking. In the end, I invariably got my way, and he would change the sonnet according to my wishes. The result is that all the sonnets he wrote for the Academy are correct in form, and every single one he wrote for other papers is incorrect in form. Up till the time when I met Crossland, I knew of him only as the author of The Unspeakable Scot, a book I have never read to this day. I asked Crossland about it, and wanted him to lend me a copy to read, but he declared that he did not possess a copy, and that if he had possessed one, he would not lend it to me. He begged me not to read it, and I promised I would not do so, and I have kept my promise. He told me it was mostly rubbish, and that he wrote it partly as a potboiler to get money, and partly to get even with 2 or 3 Scottish journalists in Fleet Street, whom he particularly disliked. As a matter of fact, he said, nearly all the few people who have been decent to me have been Scotsmen, to say nothing about you, the best and dearest friend I've ever had. After he quarrelled with me, Crossland returned to his foolish, pointless, and half-witted abuse of Scotland and Scotsmen, but as long as he was associated with me, on and off for 7 or 8 years, he carefully avoided anything of the kind. Crossland was a delightful companion when he was in good form, which in those days was pretty nearly always the case. He was, I think, at that time, really fond of me, at least I try to think so, though when he could get no more money from me, he basely deserted me. He was a perfect cormorant for money. His salary on the Academy was supposed to be £7 a week. It must be remembered that £7 before the war was worth nearly twice what it is now. It was, of course, grossly inadequate for what he was, the only journalist in London who was also a genius and a fine poet. But it was more than he had ever got before. In any case, as I invariably gave him at least £10 a week, often much more, besides having him to lunch with me every day as a matter of course, and frequently to dinner as well, during the whole time he was my assistant editor, he certainly had nothing to complain of. I do not wish to emulate Wilde's laments in De Profundis over the money he alleges he spent on entertaining me to dinner and lunch, and I do not grudge Crossland a penny of what I paid and gave and spent on him. E.g., I gave him £250 as a free gift when I sold the Academy. But I do feel his subsequent ingratitude very much. However, this is a matter on which I do not wish to enlarge. I prefer to remember that Crossland taught me all I know about journalism and editing a paper, and that in the long run he was nearly always right in his views about people and things. He did a lot for the Academy in one way, and he lifted me clean out of cheap cynicism, log-rolling, and determination to be smart, which are the bane of budding literary amateurs. I was an amateur in those days, except, of course, as regards poetry. His own articles in the Academy, as later in plain English, were models of the literary journalist's art. As a writer of articles, there has never been anyone to touch Crossland in my lifetime. He had a fine style, which was based on a most intimate knowledge of Shakespeare and all the best poets. He had infinite wit and a really Shakespearean sense of humour. Merely as a contributor, he would have made the fortune of any paper in the long run, as certain wooden-headed newspaper proprietors at last began to find out, just when his best period was nearly over. But as a manager or financial adviser on a paper, he was positively fatal. His views on finance may be best exemplified by an actual instance. About 2 or 3 years before I had the Academy, Crossland brought out a paper called The English Review, no connection with the present journal of that name, for which I wrote a series of light or nonsense verses. He was associated in this venture with the late Julius Beerbohm. On one occasion I was sitting in the office of the paper. It was one small room in a street in Soho, with Crossland and Beerbohm, when another member of the staff suddenly entered the room with a pale face and tragic mien, uttering the words, "Look here, do you know what has happened? The damned bank has honoured that cheque for £50. "Good God, the dirty dogs!" ejaculated Crossland, rising from his seat. "Well, that just about finishes us." He and Beerbohm then hastily left the room after excusing themselves to me. They had asked me to lunch. After they had gone, I extracted from the member of the staff who had brought the sad tidings the explanation of this curious scene. The balance at the bank was, it appears, something like £17.10, just enough to pay for lunch the next day or two for Crossland, Beerbohm and myself, and anyone else connected with the paper who cared to turn up, for they kept open house, although, as I subsequently discovered, they never paid their contributors. Meanwhile, they owed £50 to someone and were being pressed. Crossland's solution was simplicity itself. "We will give him a crossed cheque for the money. He will pay it into his account, which will keep him quiet for 2 or 3 days. Our bank will, of course, dishonour the cheque, and meanwhile, we must see what turns up, and we shall still have £17.10 to go on with." The horror and indignation of Crossland on discovering that the bank had paid the cheque, which had been specially cleared, and that instead of having £17.10 to their credit, he and Beerbohm were owing the bank about £32, was one of the funniest things I've ever witnessed. Crossland's ideas of finance during the 2 years when we were associated on the Academy were based on his assumption that as a lord, and related to a large number of rich and powerful families, it was obvious that I was entitled to, and would ultimately and inevitably get, stacks of boodle, as he expressed it. His visions of the future prospects of the Academy were golden and rosy. He said to me once when I was depressed, "In about another couple of years this paper will be making at least £10,000 a year. You will hear people in the streets whispering, "Who is that fair youth?" And the reply will be, "That is the wealthy Lord Alfred Douglas, who owns the academy." Then they will ask, "And who is that dazzling object by his side?" "That's Crossland," will be the reply. The essence of humour is, I believe, incongruous contrast. The idea of Crossland as a dazzling object was irresistibly funny, for he was the most strange and uncouth-looking person I've ever seen. He was always untidy, and somehow conveying the impression that he'd been to bed in his clothes. His hair hung dankly over his forehead, and when annoyed, he had a positively ferocious aspect. On the other hand, he was sometimes unexpectedly soft-hearted, and had many generous impulses and feelings. His appearance when he was smartened up and forced into evening dress, I myself having tied his tie and brushed his hair, a process which occasionally took place with many groans and protestations on his part when I was going to drag him out to dinner to meet respectable people or to go to the theatre, was really not bad at all, and he had fine eyes. Those who want to find out what was in his soul at his best, and beneath all the outward stains of financial unscrupulousness and what almost amounted to savagery, will find it by reading his best poetry, for example, the beautiful Swan Song, his best sonnets, and a glorious poem called The Finer Spirit, which is full of magical lines. End of chapter 34.